Good afternoon. We'll start the Senate Finance Committee this afternoon. It's 1:35, November 10th. Today we're joined by Senator Olson, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, and Senator Dyson. We should be having Senator Huggins joining us shortly. Senator Stedman is away on business this afternoon. We're still working on the CS, so that won't be finalized today, but should be available sometime tomorrow. This afternoon, we have an invitation from Cambridge Energy and Associates to have a presentation. We're probably going to be going till about 3 o'clock this afternoon. Members should have a copy of the presentation, and we are joined. Please join us, Mr. David Hobbs, who is the Vice President, Managing Director of Global Research for Cambridge Energy and Associates. Welcome to Senate Finance. I appreciate you coming up on such a short notice from your trip from Boston. And with that, are there any questions from the committee? We would appreciate if we could have the presentation and hold the questions, any questions that committee members might have until the end. And then and answer them at that point. We've been joined by Senator Terrio and Senator Gary Stevens. With that, Mr. Hobbs, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much indeed for giving me an opportunity to speak to you today. I will try to keep my remarks brief in order to provide as much time for questions that members of your committee might have in relation to the work that we've done. But can I start, please, by explaining who and what CERA, Cambridge Energy Research Associates, is? We are a syndicated research firm founded some 25 years ago to look at major developments in the oil and gas markets and the energy markets more generally.
Mr. Hobbs, can you state your name for the record?
Oh, I apologize, sorry. My name is David Hobbs. I'm the head of research, or managing director and vice president of global research at Cambridge Energy Research Associates, which is part of the IHS Group, a large data provider. Cambridge Energy Research Associates, otherwise known as CERA, typically works with groups of stakeholders consisting of policymakers, private companies, non-governmental organizations, to try to cast light upon contentious issues and to try and create common ground and understanding of the facts in any particular situation. We also provide syndicated retainer research, which a client base of around 400 companies buys in different parts of the energy business. And finally, we do customized consulting for clients when we're requested to do so. And we have, in the past, done a lot of work in relation to what are the drivers of companies working in the energy sector, what induces them to invest, what is it that might prevent them from doing so, of which one component of that is fiscal terms. And it was against that backdrop that we were asked to prepare a report comparing fiscal regimes. If I can summarize the results of our analysis, the first thing I should say is that the concept of a fair share, which is one that is often used in these debates, doesn't really mean anything in the sense that there is no magic number which is fair versus another number that is not fair. It is obviously the business of governments and resource holders to determine what fiscal terms are appropriate, and it's, in a sense, if those terms are not competitive, then investment won't flow, and you can't tax activity that doesn't occur. Therefore, it's in a sense, one can inadvertently cause oneself pain by getting it wrong. On the other hand, if you tax too little, then you can have either too much activity for a region to bear, or alternatively, you leave money on the table. It is in the domain of policymakers, and it's certainly not CIRA's role to recommend what a fiscal regime should be, so much as to provide our analysis of how fiscal regimes might compare against each other, because this is a dynamic equilibrium. It's not just a function of what one government does in terms of its tax regime, it's a function of how does that compare to other regimes. And so we looked at a peer group in which one might compare Alaska, and against that valid set of peers, our analysis suggests that Alaska ranks near the bottom of that peer group in terms of the economic attractiveness of investment. We look at the outlook for production in Alaska, and we see that it is declining and unlikely to reverse that decline absent a fiscal stimulus that would make Alaska more attractive than competing regimes for investment. And finally, that in terms of our conclusions, that investment decisions are based on more than just the pure economics. They're based upon the perceptions of the stability, the growth potential, and the ease of operations in any environment. And in fact, in today's environment, where costs of activity have nearly doubled since the start of the decade, the biggest shortage seems to be of engineering and project management talent. And so, for example, return on effort might be as important a measure of investment appetite as return on investment itself. If I can explain the basis of our analysis, because I think we've taken a slightly different approach than is often and typically presented in relation to fiscal comparisons, it is not uncommon to see tables showing the percentage of state take and ranking in terms of what percentage of the economic rewards is taken by the state. And our view is that this is a proxy measure. It's not actually meaningful. It's a symptom rather than an underlying important number. More sophisticated analyses of fiscal terms tend to consider an example field, whatever size it may be, 50, 100, 200 million barrels, say, and to run that field under lots of different fiscal regimes and to then compare the economic returns that can be earned in that situation. And again, this makes an oversimplification by assuming that the world is somehow homogeneous. The truth is that the different locations demand different technical challenges from people operating. And so our analysis, in fact, has built for each of the environments that we considered a bottoms-up cost model based on the inputs to a field development, the costs of manpower, the costs of steel, the costs of drilling rigs, the what does it cost to bring logistics and fabrication to a particular market, and also what does it cost to bring the production to the point of commerciality, and to build a set of field models, in this case based on 100 million barrels, on 200 million barrels and 500 million barrels, and in the case of gas, on the basis of 1 trillion cubic feet, 5 trillion cubic feet, and 10 trillion cubic feet, to give a good spread of field sizes, and then to set those fields in the different environments that we considered. So, for example, we looked at if such fields were to be developed in the Sakhalin Island area today, or if a production venture in the Alberta oil sands, not a mining operation, but an in situ through wells production operation, or in the case of Norway, an Arctic offshore field setting, in Brazil, again, deep water in the Campos Basin, and to assess what would be the costs of developing those fields under the fiscal terms in place and with the lead times to relate to the regulatory and complexity of operations, and to then compare on an apples-to-apples basis how does a dollar invested in those environments compare in terms of its return to a dollar invested in any of the others. And because of the cost structure of Alaska, we chose a peer group that had similar cost structures. And that's how we came up with the peer group that we have described in the report. We looked at a variety of oil and gas price scenarios also, again, in order just to make sure that we weren't finding results on the basis of an artifact of a single field run, but to look at whether they were broadly representative of a particular environment. And it is on that basis that we then presented the analysis, and maybe the two charts that are easiest to look at the rankings are figures 3 and 4 on page 6 of the report, where we just ranked in order. There are some quite large differences in the rates of return between two places in a ranking list. Similarly, in terms of the profit to investment ratio, you should not read it as being a linear scale so much as just in general terms, within the bounds of precision, we felt that it was appropriate to illustrate it in this way. And what this shows is that under the existing PPT regime, Alaska is in the bottom half, and that depending on exactly how the ACES proposals are enacted, that would reduce the attractiveness against the measures that we've undertaken here. But also important to reiterate that this is not the only measure of what drives a company to invest. As I said before, it is a combination of the stability, the risks associated with the operation, the opportunity for growth and the reliability of the resource, as well as such things as the environmental requirements and the regulatory requirements that are placed upon them. So that is essentially the analysis that we performed. I'd be happy to address any questions you might have about how we approach this and what do the results mean.
Senator Elton.
Mr. Hobbs, thank you. And just a real easy question. I see the peer group that you put us in, and you do list Alberta. Is this Alberta of August or Alberta of November in your analysis?
Mr. Chairman, if I can answer Senator Elton's question by saying that it is, numerically, it is the Alberta of August, prior to whatever finally is enacted by the Albertan government. But it is, and this leads to one of the qualifiers I place upon it, which is that we, in terms of the attractiveness of Alberta, the uncertainty that has been created by that activity has certainly reduced the attractiveness of investment in new ventures in Alberta.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions? Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a lot of discussion about the one thing that you did mention briefly is the stability. I have just had this chart in front of me for a couple of minutes, so I didn't flow through it to see if you have a graph or something that shows, as you do, figure 2, 3, and 4, profit to investment, full cycle, and government take. Do you have one in here that indicates how you stack that up when people are nationalizing the oil or blowing up oil lines? Is there something that kind of brings that into the picture?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to say that Senator Thomas is right. We might, if we'd expanded this analysis beyond just a fiscal analysis, have considered an index of interventions in oil lines as well. The truth is that this report was based around just the fiscal terms, but if you'd permit me, I can speak to questions of stability on the basis that I'm several thousand miles away from my wife, maybe I can use an analogy if I saw someone that I thought absolutely beautiful and asked my wife, do you mind if I were to go out with her on a date? If she said no and I said, okay, I won't, nonetheless, our relationship would have been affected by my having asked the question in the first place. And stability is a little bit the same in the sense that even talking about changing the fiscal regime can create much the same effect as even changing it. In fact, we've done some research on what happened in the UK when a couple of phases of instability occurred to their fiscal regime. In one case, the abolition of reliefs for exploration was offset by a reduction in the tax rate. such that overall, in fact, companies received a slightly larger share of their awards. But nonetheless, the uncertainty that was created and the fact that some companies were advantaged and others not resulted in a precipitous drop in activity in new ventures in the UK. Again, in 1997, when the new government came in and said that they were going to review taxation, there was a pause in activity while companies waited to see what was the effect of this. And so stability is, in that sense, is a very important concept. And if we were to rank Alaska against some of these peers in terms of stability, then it would probably not rank very high compared to a number of these areas on pure fiscal terms. In terms of the predictability of the operating environment, it might rank better than some places in Russia and elsewhere. If we were to look at how did Alberta rank until recently, as Senator Elton asked, certainly on a stability measure, Alberta would have become less attractive also.
Just one thing.
Senator Thomas?
It's good you mentioned that, because they've done psychological studies and have found that any change, whether it's good or bad, causes a reaction in people that could be the opposite of what one would expect. So thanks for recognizing that.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. Senator Huggins, Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, I appreciate you helping us and the expertise you bring. A couple of the folks who have sat where you're sitting have said, when you're making comparisons, you need to take into consideration two or three factors that are not just the present percentage of government take, but make sure whether or not it includes the royalty structure, whatever that is, not just the tax, and whatever it costs to buy in other words, the cost of the leases, and then also to ask the question of, is this a average rate, you know, or does that include 30 and 40 year old leases that may have, you know, a significantly different thing, and that maybe what we ought to be looking at is is new oil, new exploration, new opportunities, that is what we really compete against it for the investment dollar. And I would enjoy your answer both about what you've included in your comments, sir.
Mr. Chairman, if I may break that into two questions, and if I inadvertently forget the second question properly, please remind me, because it's a very important one. The first is that our analysis, and I would hope that any intellectually consistent analysis would include all imposts that effectively, so any money that doesn't go to the investor would be included in the notion of take. So even in the lower 48, where it may be a landowner royalty rather than a federal royalty, that ought to be included in the take calculation, as should the cost of acquiring the leases. In fact, this is one of the problems with the discussions going on in Alberta, is that clearly if people feel that the tax take is going to have risen, then on new leases they're going to pay less for those leases, because what they're looking for is the price they're prepared to pay for the overall economics of the thing. So we certainly incorporate in our analysis the cost of acquiring the leases, any impost, whether it goes to the resource holder being the government or the resource holder being the mineral rights holder, in the case particularly of the lower 48. And in that sense, we consider it from the perspective of what funds flow to the investing company, and treat anything that doesn't come to them as being part of the take. In answer to your second question, it is certainly a seductive notion that you can have two different tax regimes, that one applies to legacy activity and the other applies to new activity. And indeed, in competition for new investment dollars, one might think that all we need to do is have an attractive environment for those new investment dollars and everything will be okay. The problem that the oil and gas industry, and in fact any extractive mineral industry, has is that it makes investments in fixed real assets to the tune more recently of several billion dollars at a go. And it's very difficult to pick them up and take them elsewhere if the rules of the game change to a point at which that's not attractive. And the consequences of having two different regimes, one of which appears to be very attractive for new investment, is that people will evaluate that by looking at what happens after my money is put in. My wife never tires of telling me that I should have known that about her before I married her, when it turns out that she has an expensive taste in clothes or whatever else it is. And it's much the same for oil and gas companies in investing, that they look at how will they treat us after we have put our money on the table, because we can't take it away after we've done so. And so our experience of differentiated fiscal regimes is that it is very rare that this is an attractive proposition with one proviso. Where, for example, in the North Sea, legacy fields have had their fiscal regime improved in order to encourage investment in extra recovery, that has not put off investments in new ventures. But where it's been the other way round, it causes companies to pause for thought, saying, well, hang on a second, isn't that just an indicator of where I will be once I put my money on the ground?
If I may follow up.
Senator Nason.
Yeah, so first question, if somebody has to spend $1.5 million U.S. just for a lease, so that's the kind of the buy-in cost to get started. When you're putting together your comparisons, how long, over what period do you amortize that initial fee? And then the second question is, which I don't think you answered, when you're looking at these comparisons, do they go back and look back at the old leases that may have been very favorable terms in the 1930s? And is it indeed a comparison of today's terms?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, it is in response to the first, we incorporate into a fiscal model of the field the costs of acquiring the lease, and so in some jurisdictions that those leases are amortized over a straight line period, in others they are amortized instantly, and in others still they're amortized on a unit of production basis. We've applied the appropriate rules for each of the environments in which we analyzed fields. In response to the second point, we looked at how would a field over its life compare if we were to acquire the leases today at the terms that are available today, at the costs of activity that are extant today, because it is very difficult for us to know what might have been in the mind of anyone at the time they originally acquired a lease. I sometimes see advertising by the oil industry that says, it's the end of the era of easy oil. But when I think about what we consider to have been easy today, at the time that it was first developed, it was considered very difficult oil. In the North Sea, everyone knew that there was a lot of oil and gas in the North Sea long before it was developed to the extent it has been, but they thought it would be very difficult and very high cost. Just as indeed there was a long gap between the discovery of oil in Alaska and its initial commercialization, because people thought that was an extremely difficult technical challenge. Indeed, it was an extremely difficult technical challenge that required the alignment of many stakeholders to bring that to fruition.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. The state of Alaska, is contemplating changes to the tax structure in ACES. But Governor Palin, the way that Governor Palin submitted the original legislation and where we are today are completely different situations. Initially, I think that the governor had proposed a floor, and I think that the legislature, in listening to the industry, has taken that off the table. There was some discussion of taxing on the gross. And I think the legislature has listened to the industry and has shelved that plan. The stability issue of the basic tax rate of 22.5 and 25 is still under consideration, but you know, I think that many in the building are listening to the industry and are in support of 22.5 versus the 25. But a lot has changed since the Alaska legislature has adopted PPT and shelved the ELF situation. A year ago, or when that was contemplated, we weren't looking at approaching $100 a barrel oil, and weren't aware of the increased costs related to bringing gas, I mean oil, to market. So I think that what Alaska is considering today is as a result of what is happening worldwide. I think many countries are looking at changes at the high end. And I think that that's where we are today, but don't you think that other countries are also looking at what Alberta has done and what Alaska is considering to do?
Mr. Chairman, undoubtedly most significant resource-holding countries have looked at the profitability of oil and gas activity and considered whether or not there is scope for them to increase the take from those activities. And our experience has been that because it's much easier to see what the top line price and revenue number is, because that's very transparent, and much harder to look at what is the underlying cost number, because that is often far from transparent, that those governments have maybe a more optimistic view of the profitability of activity than is actually being experienced, not least because to continue to exist, companies must reinvest their cash flow, and so it's all very well if one's legacy activity is profitable, if it's being reinvested in replacing that production from less profitable sources, then the pain in that sense is certainly felt. In terms of how that debate is playing out, unquestionably there have been a majority of resource holders who have sought to increase their state take, but at the same time there has been a number of resource holding governments, and off the top of my head I'm trying to recall Colombia as an example, where the attractiveness of investment in Colombia when compared to other opportunities in Latin America had fallen to a point at which activity was falling and production was declining significantly, and they've in fact reduced their state take and made the fiscal terms more attractive in order to attract more investment, because they calculate that the benefit to the Colombian economy as a whole from larger industry activity is greater than the benefit of an increase in the fiscal take from those activities. And there are a number of others. I wish I had the list easily at hand. I could certainly provide it to you subsequently, that have recognized that in a sense one of the difficulties is that activity levels are challenged by a shortage both of personnel to conduct activities competently, and secondly by the relative attractiveness. At a time of great cost inflation, companies are finding it hard to move forward, particularly with large investments, while they seek to tie down what exactly those costs will be and to limit their exposure to potential cost inflation during the course of the project. And in that sense, although we're seeing capital investment on a worldwide basis in the MP business at record levels, in terms of when we extract out the inflation in that, it's up, but it's not up by anything like as much. And that in part is because fiscal terms have either been increased or are threatening to increase, and companies are seeking to make their investments in places that they can be most sure they will earn a return, both in terms of having some assurance of fiscal stability, but also in terms of having some assurance that their costs will also be controllable.
But Alaska, I think, led the way in setting its tax structure on progressivity. And, you know, I think that we are also cognizant of the fact that costs have been increasing. And I think that is the primary reason that the Alaska legislature has not moved to a gross system or even considered the progressivity on the gross and is setting its sights on the net on its tax structure and the net on its progressivity. So I think you view Alaska in its current PPT under the full cycle rates at near the lowest or above, just above the lowest. I think that the Alaska legislature so far has been willing to listen and modify its tax structure on the testimony of the industry.
Mr. Chairman, certainly, although this analysis was run prior to October the 18th and therefore does include the original proposal for that gross tax element, we actually examined the individual field models to find out how significant was the effect of that in there. And over the full cycle, in fact, the gross tax doesn't make a lot of difference to the attractiveness. That said, it is clearly a better environment to tax on the net than the gross, particularly when we consider, as you say, the elements of costs rising, but also the potential for prices to fall, that under those circumstances, a gross tax becomes really quite onerous. And when we look forward at the outlook for oil prices into the future, I was mentioning to Senator Dyson before we convened that if I really knew what the oil price would be on a 3, 5, and 10-year view, then we'd probably be doing this by satellite link from my Caribbean island, and so I can't claim any particular ability to foresee the future because it turns out to be so unpredictable. Nonetheless, risks such as the potential for a recession in North America that would significantly reduce the rate of demand growth could cause prices to decline quite dramatically. It seems odd at a time when we're flirting with $100 a barrel to be talking about the potential for significantly lower prices, but it certainly can't be ruled out. And in that sense, our analysis shows that regimes with a gross tax component are almost always less attractive than regimes with a net tax component. And this is one of the reasons why Norway, despite having quite a high percentage state take, is not unattractive and continues to attract investment, is because it has removed the gross element when it, back in the 90s, got rid of its royalty.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. Are there further questions? Senator Elton.
Thanks. Maybe because we have you before us, I understand that you would rather be living on a Caribbean island because you are able to predict what the future holds for energy prices. But I'm going to put this question in context and ask you for a generalization. The head of BP, Houston Chronicle reports that the head of BP this week said that fundamentally he believes that the range of the price of a barrel of oil is going to be higher than he had thought in the past. And then we have peak oil theories, for example. So I'm not asking you for a specific prediction, but given you mentioned the risk of a recession in North America, but given kind of the fundamentals, and I'm not talking about the spikes that happen because of some geopolitical thing, but given the fundamentals, do you really believe that the price of a barrel of oil is going to retreat to historical levels?
Mr. Chairman, that is certainly a question that requires maybe quite a lengthy argument. And if I may answer Senator Elton's question, if I go on too long, please hurry
shorter,
me along. But it's
shorter the better.
I will try to be short. I think that your context is exactly right. I think that the industry and as a whole was probably a victim of its own experience when prices began to rise significantly, first off in the run-up to the Iraq war, and in fact at that time it was also the combination of a general strike in Venezuela and unrest in the Niger Delta that combined with that to create a bit of a spike. And those people with a great deal of experience in the industry knew full well that a price spike would cause excess investment to come flooding in, excess productive capacity, and therefore the price would come back down. And so they all decided, based on their experience, to wait and see, to an extent, was this a short-term spike or was this a more secular trend? And in a sense, that created the environment in which, when you feed in the demand shock of Chinese demand growth being so much higher than people expected in 2004, now you've got a situation in which you're slightly running to catch back up with it. And that seems to have created in most people's minds the perception of a secular change in the oil price environment. When we look at the margins that might be earned, because in a sense the return is what matters. It's the oil companies and investing companies live in the margin between costs and prices. That you might argue that therefore $40 is the new $20 a barrel. And so when a senior person in an oil company says they believe that oil prices may be higher than we have seen in the past, if prices were to retreat back to the $40 a barrel level, that would, in terms of performance for oil companies, probably be worse than when oil prices were back at $20 a barrel a decade and some ago. So in that context, will we see prices revert to their historical levels? In absolute terms, I very much doubt it. In relative terms, I could foresee a situation in which prices do revert to their historical level. There is no doubt at all in our minds that the underlying fundamentals do not support a price as high as it is today. That doesn't mean that the price won't go higher, because the price is not set just by the fundamentals, but also by people's perceptions of those fundamentals. But that if you were to remove the factors that are causing prices to trade higher than the fundamentals would suggest, markets typically overcorrect. And so I could see a situation in which they overshot to a point at which they would be below what the fundamentals might suggest. And finally, I would add that while we might see costs as having risen to a point at which they provide a floor at a higher level than historically we have seen, don't forget that in the early 1980s, the costs were at a level which, in relative terms today, are probably as high as they are today. And through the application of technology and through discipline in project execution, the industry did better than halve the costs of activity, which in a sense was the reason that prices were able to retreat down into the 20s and even as low as $10 a barrel during that decade.
And this didn't perfectly lead into the follow-up question like I thought it might, so I admit that up front. But it gets back to the question the chair asked a little bit earlier. I mean, I don't understand when I take a look at your different figures here, your different charts, that goes from lowest to highest and highest to lowest. I can't understand how Alaska ACES falls below the Alaska PPT. It seems to me that if you have a net floor of 22.5 in both, and if the rest of the government take depends upon progressivity, and royalty issue, the royalty is the same. I don't understand why the governor's proposal ranks less than PPT.
At the time that we did this analysis. The proposal on ACES had a 25% rate versus the 22.5% of PPT, so that would account for a component of that. And indeed, the reason that there is a range is because we did look at the range of different royalty rates on the leases, ranging from, if I recall correctly, 12.5% up to 20%, depending on the terms on which the leases were awarded. And so that's the reason that you see, for example, in Figure 3, that in fact, under PPT, that range of royalty rates doesn't cause it to jump a place in the ranking, whereas under ACES, that range of royalty rates would cause it to straddle Norway and Alberta, depending on whether it was the higher or lower royalty. But as it was published at the time that we did this analysis, ACES simply had a higher starting tax rate, and that was the main reason that ACES ranked worse than PPT in that situation.
And Mr. Chair, I may have misspoke, because you're right, ACES does have 25, but let's assume that it's 22.5, whatever comes out of here is 22.5. Can I then assume that, given your graphs here, can I then assume that the attractiveness of Alaska as a place to invest would essentially be the same as PPT from last year?
If in all, Mr. Chairman, if in all fundamental respects the ACES proposal were numerically similar to the PPT, the existing PPT regime, then indeed the ACES proposals would not move the ranking in fiscal terms, in terms of the fiscal attractiveness. However, if I can recall the question that Senator Thomas raised, the impact would nonetheless be a net negative in terms of people's appetite for investment, because any change, even a marginal improvement, causes people to stop and to think about, is this really an improvement? You know, this uncertainty creates a negative impact on the situation.
Thanks for your forbearance, Mr. Chair. I mean, when I heard you testify in response to Senator Thomas's question, I heard your possible answer as being that if in fact, and I've used this analogy too much, it's a deer hunting analogy. I mean, if you shoot at a deer, the first shot's always the easiest. Second shot is always much more difficult. But the first shot induces as much angst in the deer as a second shot may. So when I heard your response to Senator Thomas, what I was essentially hearing is, let's do a tax that everybody, industry and state, looks as durable and reliable over time. And that will get us the stability. I suspect that if we leave here without having done anything, that will be more destabilizing than leaving here with an answer that people can say we can live with this for a period of time. That's the flip side of your answer, but I just suspect that it is less destabilizing to come up with an answer that people are comfortable with than it is to leave here with essentially all of these other issues that have surrounded the debate about PPT. Am I wrong in assuming that that's a possible outcome?
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond firstly to the deer hunting analogy, which I'm only hearing for the first time, and therefore it's certainly not tired with me, and I would only seek to add to it, which is that I think that as a hunter myself, I've always found the second shot an awful lot more stressful than the first. From my perspective, I hadn't until now considered how it was for the deer. In terms of the specifics of your question, I could not definitively answer one way or the other. I am sure that if industry truly believes that there is a greater prospect of long-term stability because there is a consensus that appears to be durable, then that is a better situation than if industry perceives there to be no consensus and certainly no durable settlement. I think that your question, however, was in a sense more subtle and nuanced than I may have answered it. What I would say is that I don't think it is necessarily the flip side of my response to Senator Thomas, in the sense that undoubtedly if the original settlement had been considered durable and this debate had never arisen, that would be a better situation than having had this debate, even if the outcome is a fiscal regime that is in all material respects unchanged from the current one. And so I don't see an inconsistency between those two positions, but that certainly you are right that the more durable people perceive the outcome to be, the more certain they will be about their ability to invest. I really have not done the work that would allow me to say authoritatively how the particular outcome here in Alaska would play.
Thanks. I appreciate that, and I know it's a difficult question. I mean, I just suspect that if, in fact, we leave here without a different tax or tweaks to the existing tax, I suspect that the discussion in Alaska is going to be every bit as virulent as in the next year as it has been in the past year.
Well, I don't mean to sound like a bumper sticker, and certainly I would urge you to look past the bumper sticker nature of the statement that the investment cycle in the oil and gas industry is longer than the electoral cycle in almost any jurisdiction, and that creates a tension, if you like, in terms of companies becoming comfortable with how durable a settlement might be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Elton. Senator Dyson and Senator Thomas.
Thank you. My next question is not in any way to impugn your testimony, but how did you come to be here, and who's paying for you being here?
Mr. Chairman, we were invited to come here, and the cost of my being here has been funded by ExxonMobil. And they funded the production of this paper. We work with a lot of organizations in a number of different ways, and this is typical of one way in which it occurs, that we decline any engagement where we are asked to generate new content for funding, because that puts a question mark over our impartiality. As I said right at the start, our preference is actually to work with groups of stakeholders, including policymakers, including companies, so that then no side can be perceived to have captured our opinion, because we are aiming just to cast light on an issue on behalf of all participants. In this particular instance, this work is a reflection of work that we had previously produced in relation to our syndicated research, in which I guess we have 110 companies can participate in our global oil service. And as a client of that, ExxonMobil would have been aware what is CIRA's intellectual property in the space of fiscal regimes, and that was the reason that they came to us, and the reason we were prepared to accept that engagement was because we were simply being asked to publish in customized form, if you like, for the public domain, because most of what we do doesn't go into the public domain, research which we had previously identified. So in a sense, this content predates the fact that ExxonMobil paid, but nonetheless, ExxonMobil funded us to be here today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding your report, and I'm concentrating somewhat on the first several figures that are in here, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and from that I glean at least to that Russia, East Siberia, United Kingdom are particularly attractive to investment. Do you find that is the reality with what's taking place, as far as maybe not necessarily volume but rate anyhow, or both, as far as investment in those two areas?
Mr. Chairman, I would reiterate that The rankings here show purely on the basis of fiscal attractiveness, and in that sense, East Siberia ranks very high on almost any measure, in part because the Russian government is providing significant incentives to try and encourage activity. What makes East Siberia less attractive to companies are two things. Firstly, the distance from liquid markets for its output, and the second is the perception of how stable are your ownership rights in East Siberia in the event that you have success in your ventures. So certainly these rankings do not allow you to infer simply that East Siberia is the most attractive high-cost environment in which one can invest. But it is certainly the case that investment activities in the UK have been growing in real terms of late, that activity in exploration in the UK is certainly greater than exploration activity in Norway, which ranks below the UK in this context, and that activity in Brazil, similarly, if I look at these figures, where Brazil again ranks quite high, there is a lot of international investment going into Brazil. It will be very interesting to see how the government's decision to pull out of their mooted license round a lot of acreage that has just been shown to be prospective by a discovery made by a group that is majority Petrobras will impact companies' perceptions of the ownership stability in Brazil. And again, this report predates that particular activity. So this is one of several indicators that would point to the attractiveness of activity, and that we do generally find that companies are looking to develop their resources off the east coast of Canada. They are looking to develop their resources offshore Brazil and in the United Kingdom. And so the companies that are highest ranked within this peer group, in general terms, do seem to be getting, in investment volume terms, a good share.
Thank you. And just one last thing there. With that thought of the stability aspect of various countries, and as we seem to be, there seems to be a kind of a squeezing of the areas that are potentially available, and obviously the industry wants to expand their reserves. So how do you see that affecting the future as far as what people do? If you were just to get away from your particular charts here anyhow and speculate on that activity as people are nationalizing and or actually throwing people out of their countries, what does that do to the shrinking pie that exists, so to speak?
Mr. Chairman, there are certainly a number of companies who appear to be a number of North American companies, both Canadian and United States-based, who appear to be coming home and bringing more of their investment back into what are perceived to be lower cost environments, whether that is driven by resource nationalism or a perception of fiscal instability. It would be difficult to assign a particular quantity to different factors. But at the same time, it's worth noting that there are a growing number of companies in Canada, for example, who are investing internationally and in countries that we might consider risky, in fact, a growing number of private equity-backed companies exploring internationally in riskier environments. In terms of the volumes of fund flows, probably a net increase in coming back to less risky environments. At the same time, what we're seeing is a significant increase in investment in some of these perceived riskier places by the quasi-state companies from China, from India, from Korea. We're seeing Petrobras, for example, investing significantly more. We're seeing Statoil, investing significantly in perceived risky environments. And that leads one to a conclusion that how risky somewhere is not an absolute quantity, it is a relative quantity. It depends who you are. That Venezuela may be a riskier environment for a US incorporated company than it is for a Chinese company or for a Norwegian company or whomever. And so it would be difficult to generalize about the shrinking universe of investment opportunities, but certainly for some companies who find that their traditional investment environments are becoming more hostile, they will be looking to places that they are able to invest.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. Senator Elton.
Thank you. In the charts, you say United Kingdom. We were shown a chart the other day that shows there are two tax rates in the United Kingdom. One is 50% for new fields and exploration. The other is much closer to 70%. I can't remember exactly what the number was. So when you say United Kingdom, are you talking about a blend of old and new, or are you talking about new?
In the specific situation, Mr. Chairman, that we analyzed here, it was a post-1992 field regime that we use. Therefore, it is new, as you've designed it, Senator. And in fact, it may be worth just understanding the process by which you end up with those two different regimes. In the case of those fields that have effectively a 70% state marginal take, they have come through an environment in which they initially experienced petroleum revenue tax at 75%, they experienced royalty at 12.5%, and they experienced over and above that corporate income tax at rates historically as high as 40%. That with prices being very much lower in the early 1990s than they had historically been, firstly, royalty was repealed for all fields, including those old fields. Secondly, the rate of petroleum revenue tax was brought down to 50%, and corporation tax in the UK came down to around about 30%. Subsequently, post-1997, the UK government then introduced what it called supplementary corporation tax, which applies to all fields, old and new, which was the reason that there is now a 50% rate of taxation on new fields and effectively about 70-something percent as a result of applying the 50% petroleum revenue tax and then a 50% rate on a 30% rate on top of that in terms of the net that's left over. And so you do have two different regimes, but it was a function of new activity was given a tax break rather than that old activity was retroactively taxed more highly than had been the case. And as I think I answered earlier, we find that having two tax rates is sometimes or is in general terms unattractive, except in the situation where it is a question of reducing taxes from a status quo in order to encourage some form of activity. In the case of the old fields, the petroleum revenue tax rate was brought down from 75 to 50% in order to make investment in enhanced recovery more attractive. And in the case of new investment, petroleum revenue tax was scrapped in its entirety in order to support the economics of new exploration and development.
Mr. Chair, I'd hate to be tested on this. I feel like I'm kind of in a classroom, but you gave a long explanation of the different changes that have happened in the UK.
Yes.
But I probably just missed it in your answer, Mr. Hobbs. I'm not sure what we're comparing here. Are we comparing compared against the UK at 50%? Are we compared at 70%, or are we compared at some percentage in between?
It's at the 50% rate. It is new fields, which have 30% corporation tax and then a gross 20% supplementary corporation tax, which brings the rate up to 50.
Okay, so if I could follow up then, Mr. Hobbs. So you're comparing us against the new fields. I mean, if we have 100 barrels of oil coming out of the UK, how many of those are coming from the new fields and how many are coming from the old fields?
I don't have off the top of my head specific numbers for that. If I think about what is, because new fields are in fact any field that received its development consent after 1992. And I would hazard that it may be about half and half, but I would need to go and check to give you an answer that I could be confident in.
So would I be, Mr. Chair, so would I be correct that it may be a fairer comparison between Alaska and the UK if we were comparing, if we took out the legacy fields and the taxation rate on legacy fields here in Alaska and compared kind of our kind of new production versus their new production, if you're indeed using the 50% rate?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that it would be a fair comparison if we were to consider two parts of production, one being legacy and the other being new, if we were to consider a regime in which the legacy production had a reduction in its tax, as has the legacy production in the UK, and that the new activity had the near abolition of its taxes, as was the case in the UK. And I'm not sure that that is the situation that's contemplated under ACES, as I currently understand it. But it may well be that the numbers for legacy production in Alaska and the potential future production may reach a point at which they're about 50-50, and in that sense, there may be some comparability.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Elton. Any final questions? Seeing none, thank you for traveling all this way from Boston, Mr. Hobbs. Tomorrow's schedule is we will be convening, as I understand it, at 1 p.m. Here tomorrow. With that, we're adjourned.